as the years go by, it becomes more and more difficult to understand some of these older hymns because we just don't use some of the words and we become increasingly divorced from the land, and so we don't understand what is being spoken about. I wonder how many people, I'm not asking for a show of hands, because it might embarrass those who don't put their hands up. What does the word supernal mean? And what is a garner? Perfectly good words. What on earth do they mean? And I'm not going to tell you, because I want the children to go home and look them up. Because if they look them up, then they'll remember what they mean. If I tell them, it will just go right over their heads and they'll forget it. So when you go home, you can look up what the words supernal and garner mean. In fact, you should find that garner is a noun, that is, it's a thing, and it's a verb, that means it's something that is done. So a bit of homework for you. And I put it that way so that the adults who look at those words and think, I don't know what those mean either, you can go home and look them up as well and not be embarrassed. Well, for those of you with long memories, you will know that today will be the 18th time that I have preached on the subject of harvest. It's the 18th time I have stood here on a harvest Thanksgiving and turned to the Bible to see what the Bible has to say on the subject. How often, you might think, is it possible to preach on exactly the same subject without saying exactly the same thing, as was said last year, and the year before, and the year before that, and the year before that, and so on, almost ad infinitum? And some of you will probably say, hang on, didn't you say exactly the same last year? I haven't checked, so I'm not certain. But it is true to say that for any preacher, there is the problem when you come to these regular events, that after you've been in the same place for a long time, the question you have in your mind is, what can I say this year that I haven't said already? Indeed, it is said of a certain kind of minister, I won't mention denomination, but it is said of a certain kind of minister that he will never stay for more than 3 years in one church, because after that time he can't think of anything else to say, so he moves on to the next one, and he starts again with the same batch of sermons that he used at the previous church until he's gone through those, and then, oh, it's time for me to move on again. Well, I've now been here for over 17 years, and some people's hearts sink and think, oh, good grief, how much longer have we got to put up with him? I have no intention of leaving just yet. So your hearts sink even further into your boots. Well, hopefully not. One of the things that we remember at this time of year is that it is God who supplies us with everything that we need. And that means everything that we need. If we turn back to the second easiest chapter in the Bible to find, Genesis chapter 1, and you have to turn past the preface and the explanation of the features and the table of contents, and you get to Genesis chapter 1. We find in verse 11, God said, "Let the earth sprout vegetation, plants yielding seed, and fruit trees bearing fruit, in which is their seed, each according to its kind on the earth." And it was so. The earth brought forth vegetation, plants yielding seed according to their own kinds, and trees bearing fruit in which is their seed, each according to its kind. And God saw that it was good. And there was evening and there was morning, the third day. And then the next day, God said, "Let there be lights in the expanse of the heavens to separate the day from the night, and let them be for signs and for seasons, and for days and years, and let them be lights in the expanse of the heavens to light upon the earth." And it was so. God made the two great lights, the greater light to rule the day and the lesser light to rule the night, and the stars. And God set them in the expanse of the heavens to give light on the earth, to rule over the day and over the night, and to separate the light from the darkness. And God saw that it was good, and there was evening and there was morning, the fourth day. I'm not going to spend the next half hour expounding to you about the truth of this chapter and the fact that just because there are professed scientists who disagree with what this chapter says and the reasons why they are wrong, we can believe this chapter because God was there when this happened and God has told us about it. These scientists work there, they make assumptions. Are the assumptions valid? Let me give you just one example. They say, well, we can see stars that are millions of light years away. It's taken the light millions of years to get from there to here. So therefore the universe must be certainly millions of years old. They say billions of years old. But they're making an assumption. We don't know if their assumption is true. The assumption is that the speed of light has always been the same. We don't know that. We've only measured it for about 150 years. So that short space of time, we've measured the speed. We don't even know how fast light was 1,000 years ago, let alone 1,000,000 years ago. We don't know. It's an assumption. If the assumption is true, then the conclusion is valid. But is the assumption true? We don't know. There's no scientific way of knowing the answer to that question. And so you see that when people say Genesis chapter 1 can't be true, it's based upon unprovable assumptions. And there are so many other assumptions that people make. Speaking as a scientist, I have no problems in believing that what God has told us in Genesis chapter 1 is true. And that I have no problems with believing that the sun and the moon were not created until the fourth day, which is what we're told here in the verses that we just read. And we're told the reason why God put the sun and the moon in the sky. They were for signs and for seasons. They were to help us with a calendar to measure the passing of the years, the passing of the seasons. And it's because of the way the earth is positioned in relation to the sun and to the moon that we have the kind of world we do. If the earth was not tilted on its axis, we would not know the variety of seasons that we have. Because the earth is tilted, at this time of the year, later on in the month, at this time of year, the tilt is pretty much straight at the sun. But as the earth goes round, as the earth goes round, Britain being here, we are further away from the sun than Australia. The consequence is they get more sun, we get less sun, we have winter, they have summer. As we go round and you get to the middle of the summer, Britain is now nearer the sun. We get more sun than the Australians do. And so therefore they have winter, we have summer. Well, that's because the earth is tilted. Why is the earth tilted? People have come up with all sorts of explanations. It's all guesswork. It's all speculation. There is no evidence. But we can say that's how God made the world. God made the world for it to be inhabited. God made the world for there to be days, days and years and seasons. That's the way God made the world. God made the world for us and for our benefit as somewhere for us to live, and somewhere to know Him and to enjoy Him. The very reason that we have Harvest Thanksgiving is a reminder to us that God made the world, that God made the world like it is. He made the world like it is for our benefit, and He made the world to be consistent in order that we can make predictions, in order that we can know if we plant seeds at a certain time of year, following periods of sun and rain, then we will have a harvest. If that were not the case, then we would plant and think, well, I wonder if it's going to come up this year. And all sorts of strange things happened, and oh dear, no food. Then we all starve. God has made the earth to operate in a particular way. And even after God cursed the world, you read on into chapter 3, and you read that man, Adam and Eve, rebelled against God, and because of that rebellion, God cursed the world. Part of that curse is that we die. Part of that curse is that work is hard. There are weeds growing up along with the good seed, which means you have to labour harder to get the food out of the ground. All these things are, all the unpleasant things that are in the world are as a consequence of man's rebellion against God. But you continue reading and you find that so rebellious had man become, so corrupt had the world come, God said, I've had enough. And He destroyed the world except for Noah and his family and the animals that were with him on the ark. And we read earlier in chapter 8 about the floodwaters subsiding and eventually the earth drying out. And you have this picture. Noah sent out a dove to find out how things were going. And when the dove comes back with a freshly plucked olive leaf, he knew that plants, trees, were starting to grow again. He knew it was now safe to come out of the ark. Just as an aside, you hear people constantly saying what a dreadful thing religion is, and wouldn't it be good to get rid of it, and yet they'll still use the dove as a symbol of peace, and they'll still use the olive branch. It doesn't say branch, it says leaf. But they'll still use the olive branch from this passage as a symbol of peace. And I'm not absolutely certain, but is not the symbol of the United Nations got olive leaves round it? People love the pictures. They don't like the story. But at the end of the chapter, God, having destroyed the world because of the wickedness of men, having preserved Noah in his family because he was a righteous man in the sight of God, God makes a covenant with Noah. Now this goes on into chapter 9, but the end of chapter 8 is the important part. Having said that he will never again strike down every living creature as I have done, never again will I destroy the whole world with a flood, while the earth remains, seed time and harvest, cold and heat, summer and winter, day and night shall not cease. The world will continue in that consistent way right up until the end. One, I think it was in October, some years ago, must be about 10 years ago, I did an assembly at the local school, and I said to them, if you come to my house, you will find on my car there are lots and lots of yellow leaves which had fallen from the trees and landed on the car. We'll change the picture slightly. Of going to a field of wheat, or perhaps a field of corn, because there's the sweet corn that's being grown down the road every year. Whatever picture you like, but every year you can go there and you can see that the product has grown up and then it is being harvested. And then you think back to last year, and it was the same again. The product had grown and it was being harvested. And what happened the year before? The product had grown and it was being harvested. And I won't bore you to tears by going back over the last 1,000 years. Year by year by year. Because by the time you got to 3 o'clock, you'd probably all be fast asleep. But 1,000 years ago, you would have observed crops growing, crops being harvested at this time of year. You go back 2,000 years, 4,000 years, it's the same. Year after year after year after year. And the problem of the preacher is it's so boring because every year is the same. God has blessed the earth with a harvest of crops which are being harvested. Now, we increasingly do not understand these things. We are increasingly divorced from the land, from the process. You go to schools and you ask the children, where does bread come from? They say it comes from Sainsbury's, or from Tesco's, or whichever supermarket their parents happen to frequent. Where does beef come from? It comes from the meat cabinet. Where else does it come from? And it comes as a surprise to them when you say to them, you see that cow walking in the field. That's where beef comes from. They're shocked. Well, we have over the years tried to sanitize where it's come from. Why do we call cow meat beef? It comes from the French word, bœuf. Similarly with pork. Why do we call pig meat pork? Again, it comes from, I think, the French, if not the Latin. Almost trying to hide where it comes from. Trying to sanitize it. Those of you that have ever watched the food programs with Hugh Fearnley Whittingstall, you'll know that he doesn't believe in sanitizing such things. He takes townies down onto his farm and he says, right, we're going to have lamb tonight. I think we'll have that one. And he takes them with the animal, usually animals, to the slaughterhouse so they can see the animal being slaughtered. And then he expects them to assist in the cleaning up of the carcass. So that they appreciate, they understand that this isn't just something that comes straight on a plate. This is something that has grown. It's been looked after. It's been tended until the point where the animal is slaughtered. And he's very keen on using every single item of the animal in question. My father has always said that there's only one part of a pig that is never consumed, and that's its squeak. The rest of it is used, and you'll find that's the case with most animals that are used for food. They use everything. It's not necessary that we eat it, but every part of it is used in some way or other. You talk to children about where does bread come from? Oh, it comes from the supermarket. But they've never understood that those things that wave around in the field, which is called wheat, that has to be planted, it has to grow, it has to be harvested, it has to be threshed, you have to remove the wheat from the chaff, it has to be ground, and then if you're a white bread fan, then the bran has to be removed, from the wheat germ. Various processes it goes through, it's baked, and then you get the loaf of bread sliced and wrapped in polythene. Most people don't understand this. You wonder, what do they teach children at school these days that they don't understand these things? And yet these are things that were basic even 100 years ago, perhaps even 50 years ago. Everybody knew where things came from. But we don't seem to know that anymore. We just think in terms of supermarkets, and that's it. There's more to it than that. But in seeing this, in understanding how things are planted, how things are reared, how they grow, and how they are harvested, it reminds us of the constancy and the consistency of God and the way God deals with us. The seasons come, the seasons go, and we can know that unless the world comes to an end in the next 12 months, unless Christ returns to judge the world in righteousness, we know that in a year's time, most of us will be here again. Once again, remembering God's goodness to us in the harvest. And we'll doubtless whinge and moan and complain over the course of the year that things don't happen just as we like them. At the moment, everybody's complaining, global warming, it's too hot. 50 years' time, they'll probably be complaining, it's too cold, because we'll have global cooling. It goes in cycles. People are complaining at the moment about Greenland and the ice sheet on Greenland. 1,000 years ago, Greenland was named Greenland for a very good reason. It was green. Since then, things have changed. The earth has cooled down. At the moment, it's heating up again. Very simple way of dealing with global warming. Turn the sun down. Because you can't. We've got to learn to live with it. We need to be careful with the resources that God has given us. But there's nothing we can do, ultimately, because it's the sun that provides the heat. It's the sun that makes the earth warm. If you want to solve global warming, turn the sun down. But we complain when things don't go as we expect. We've complained about the floods earlier this year. I'm talking about we as a nation. We complained about the floods. Well, if you build houses on a floodplain, don't be surprised if you get flooded. It's basic common sense. But we just go ahead willy-nilly without thinking about the way the world works, how God has set the world working, and then complain when things don't work out as we think they should work out. We think we can control the world. We can't. We have to live with the world as it is, as God has made it, not in the way that we wish he had made it. We complain about these variations. And yet we should be grateful that God is a constant God, that he upholds the world. Jesus was criticized by the Jews for calling God his own father. And in John chapter 5 and verse 17, he says, "My father is working still, and I am working." And the Jews hated him because they realized that in calling God his father, he was saying that he himself was God as well. But the point he's making is this: God works all the time. God works Sundays through to Saturdays, all the time. Because if God didn't, the world would fall apart, the universe would fall apart. We're told in Hebrews chapter 1 verse 3 that Jesus Christ upholds the universe by his word of power. If it were not for God maintaining the world, maintaining the whole universe, everything would cease to exist. The world continues to exist because God chooses to allow it to continue to exist. things happen in a constant and consistent way, because that's the way God upholds the world. If God at any moment chooses to do something in a different way, we would call it a miracle. And some people say miracles don't happen because the laws of physics dictate. Well, I don't know which parliament passed these laws and why they can never be changed. The so-called laws of physics are merely observations that people have made, and they've said, when I drop a ball, it falls to the ground, and it falls at a certain rate. And you go anywhere in the world and you drop a ball and it will fall to the ground at the same certain rate. You go to the moon and you drop a ball, it will fall to the ground, but it will fall slower because gravity is different. And they can make confident predictions. Things happen this way. Every time I do them, they happen this way. Therefore, that's a law. What they should say is, usually, God rules the world in this way, so that a ball will fall to the ground at a certain rate. But we read of occasions in Scripture where God chooses to do things in a different way. We call that a miracle. It's God choosing to do things in a slightly different way. But the conclusion we can draw from this is that God has not just been constant up to now. God will be constant and consistent in the future. We can know that when God makes a statement, that statement is true. While the earth remains, seed time and harvest, earth, cold and heat, summer and winter, day and night shall not cease. God has said this. It has been observed to be true since that time. It will continue to be true while the earth remains. God is true to his word. In the next chapter, God made a covenant with Noah. And in verse 12 he said, "This is the sign of the covenant that I make between me and you and every living creature that is with you for all future generations. I have set my bow in the cloud, and it shall be a sign of the covenant between me and the earth. When I bring clouds over the earth and the bow is seen in the clouds," that's the rainbow, of course, "I will remember my covenant that is between me and you and every living creature of all flesh, and the waters shall never again become a flood to destroy all flesh." Note all, not some, all. God is not there promising he'll never flood the earth. He's promising he'll never flood the whole earth. So God, when he says something, can be relied upon in what he says. What he says is true. If he says he will do something, he'll do it. God has spoken here while the earth remains. The earth is not going to remain forever. The earth is going to end. There is going to be a time when God decides enough is enough. And at that time, Jesus Christ will return. It might be today. It might not be for many thousand years. We don't know. We have no way of knowing. But whenever that is, that will be the end of the world. When the world ends, there will be a judgment, when God will hold to account every person who has ever lived. God will hold you to account for what you have done with the life that God has given you. Oh, people say, but I didn't ask to be born. Sorry, that's not relevant. You belong to God. You are God's possession. And God expects you to live in the way that he has decreed. But I belong to me and I'll live life my way. No, you don't belong to you. You belong to God. We all belong to God. And we should live life the way that God has said. And on the day of judgment, God will hold each one of us to account. And we will all be found to be lacking. None of us will be good enough to be accepted by God, because we have all, since Adam, we have all gone our own way. We have all chosen to do what we want to do, rather than to do what God has said. Very often we've not even been thankful to him for harvests, even though we are dependent upon that to live, otherwise we have no food. In the light of the fact there is a judgment to come, how should we live and what should we believe? God tells us very plainly in the Bible that there is only one hope for us. Some people immediately say, oh, I'll go and live a good life. But we don't. We can't. It's against human nature. Human nature is always to do our own thing and not God's. And it still doesn't deal with what's happened in the past. You can't erase your past. Some of us have done things in the past we wish we hadn't. We wish we could forget them. We can't. Because they're things we did. And we know they were wrong. And sometimes they come back and haunt us. God will judge us for those things, and God will punish us appropriately for what we've done. He won't punish us less than we deserve, and he won't punish us more than we deserve. But there is one way of avoiding that punishment, and God, having proved himself to be a good, a loving, and a kind God in providing us with all that we need, by giving us the harvests, has also sent into the world a means whereby we can be forgiven for all the things we have ever done wrong in the past and all the things we ever will do wrong in the future. And that is, God sent his own Son, the Lord Jesus Christ, into the world. And Christ came into the world to tell us the truth, but most especially he came to die. And when he died, he was punished. Not for anything he'd done wrong. When he died on the cross, he was punished for what you have done wrong, for what I have done wrong. And God says to us, all you have to do is to admit that you're in the wrong and to surrender your life to Jesus Christ. Submit to him, listen to him, do as he says, and you will receive in your heart the forgiveness of sin. And this isn't something that you have to work at. It's a matter of trust. It's a matter of belief. It's not just a question of saying, yes, I believe the facts are true. It's the difference between watching that man who's many years ago went across Niagara Falls on a tightrope, then he went across with a wheelbarrow, then he went across with a sack of potatoes, then he went across with someone sitting in the wheelbarrow. Had you been there and someone had said to you, do you believe that this man can safely transport you across that tightrope from this side to the other side? You'd have said, oh yes, I believe he could do that. Right, you're the next volunteer. Get in the wheelbarrow. You'd have probably said, you've got to be kidding. I'm not getting in there. Well, you might acknowledge there are certain things that are true, but you're not trusting. Trusting means getting into the wheelbarrow. It's no good saying, I believe certain facts about Jesus Christ are true. You have to trust Jesus Christ. You have to submit to him and surrender to him. You have to get into the proverbial wheelbarrow. And if you do that, then you will be part of the great harvest of souls that the Bible speaks about. A great harvest of people which no man can number, who will spend eternity with God in glory. Not because you're good. Not because you're better than anybody else. But because you have trusted in Jesus Christ. I used to do life saving at school. long time ago. I think I've forgotten most of it now. I have a Royal Life Saving Society bronze medallion. Can you imagine diving into the sea, swimming out to a drowning person, putting your arms round them in the appropriate way, bringing them back to the shore, if necessary, giving them artificial respiration, mouth to mouth or the Hilger-Nielsen method, whichever you find most appropriate, and when they splutter, and they recover, and they say, "Wasn't I wonderful? Did you see the way I was rescued from the sea? Aren't I great?" Everyone would say, "You're mad. You didn't do anything. Someone saved you." It's just like that when God saves us by Jesus Christ. It's not something to boast about and say, "Aren't I wonderful?" If you meet someone who says, "Well, of course, I'm a Christian, so I'm better than you are," you know that they're not a Christian. A Christian says, "I am worse than all. I am the lowest of the low. Isn't God wonderful? Isn't Jesus Christ glorious? Because of what he has done for me." And at this time of harvest, we need to ask ourselves whether we will be part of that great harvest that God will reap at some point in the future. And will we be able to say, "God is glorious, God is good, God has forgiven me because of what Jesus Christ has done." I hope that this harvest will mean a harvest of many souls being brought to God through Christ, and who will know in their hearts the forgiveness of their sins and the absolute certainty of heaven yet to come.